Hi, everybody. Is that right? Okay. So we're in Sesshin this weekend. It's a formal retreat, and the theme of the retreat is hearing the cries of the world, which is the translation of the name of this statue right here, Avalokiteshvara. So I've been talking this weekend a little bit about bodhisattvas, and I'm going to talk today about some more. So bodhisattvas are beings who aspire to awakening, and they stay in the world to help all other beings. When I knew I was going to be talking about this, I got out one of my favorite Buddhist reference books, Faces of Compassion by Tigan Layton. He wrote this book as a reference, and he literally wrote the book on bodhisattvas. Tigan did. So in this book, he goes through a number of the more well-known ones, and talks about what their meaning is, what they're known for, how they're depicted in paintings and in statues, and he tells stories about them from the sutras, and he talks about people who living today or recently who sort of personify the attributes of these different bodhisattvas. So I want to talk about that today. The thing about bodhisattvas means enlightening being. And the thing about them is they are none other than us. You know? They're mythical features, they're mythical beings, they're archetypes, but they're also ways of describing how we operate in the world. Let me read you his description of a bodhisattva. So this is from Tigan's book. If all beings have the capacity for clear, open, awakened awareness posited by the teaching of Buddha nature, then by seeing the bodhisattvas as archetypes, patterns, or approaches to awakening activity, we may learn models with which we can each express the elements of our own enlightening and beneficial nature. So, I've been intending for a long time to give this talk about several of the most well-known bodhisattvas and tell you about them and invite you to see if there's one that resonates with you, you know? If you see something in the description that reminds you of yourself, or how your energy sort of manifests, or someone else that you know, then I'd like us to share some examples of that afterwards. So, and I brought down from the third floor a couple of statues of bodhisattvas. We have Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, on our altar all the time. And up on the third floor, we have Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Compassion, and Jizo Bodhisattva. I'll talk about him in a little bit. I want to start off with Manjushri Bodhisattva. Manjushri is the essence of wisdom. So he's sort of the personification of wisdom in the Buddhist pantheon of bodhisattvas. His name means noble, gentle one. And in most of the statues that you see of Manjushri, like ours here, he sits on top of a lion. And in some of the statues, you'll see him wielding a big sword. And it's a sword that cuts through delusion. Manjushri is known for being able to look into things with penetrating wisdom and then just cut right through to the core of it. So some of the depictions have this sword that he uses to cut through delusion, and it's also said that he can cut things into two, or he can cut things into one. That's just the kind of guy Manjushri is. Sometimes also he holds a sutra or a text. And the lion represents Manjushri's nobility and his fearlessness. And you'll notice, like most of the lions that you'll see on Manjushri statues, ours is not a fierce, ferocious-looking lion. It's kind of calm and stately. So, Manjushri is known for wisdom, and especially for recognizing non-separation, sort of non-duality, and also for having insight into the fact that our most cherished views are just ideas. They don't have a separate reality of their own. So his wisdom is more than knowledge. Manjushri's wisdom is more than knowledge, and it doesn't come from study or accomplishments. It comes from his own inner vision and his own concentrated insight. In a lot of the sutras, in many sutras, you'll find Manjushri as the bodhisattva who questions Buddha on the other's behalf. You know, he'll ask the questions that help clarify the teaching for everybody else. In Taigen's book, he gives a couple of exemplars of Manjushri. One of them is Einstein, and Einstein's well known for his penetrating wisdom, for seeing things that nobody else did. And Taigen quotes him at one point as having said, right after the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Einstein said, "Everything has changed except our way of thinking." So he could see that the world was completely different. Completely different. You know, when I was a little girl, in the 50s, in school, they would have us, you know, practice drills for what we'd do if the bomb dropped. And it involved getting underneath your desk. So we could have used a little Manjushri wisdom. But, you know, I look back on that now and I reflect. In just one generation, we went from being afraid of things that were nearby that could hurt you to being afraid of things on the other side of the world that could destroy the world. It's an entirely different set of fears. And yet, in a lot of ways, nothing about the way that we've come up with to deal with conflicts internationally has changed. So we could use a little Manjushri wisdom in the leadership of the whole world these days. We haven't come to grips with it. Another person that Taigen points out as an exemplar of Manjushri kind of wisdom is Gloria Steinem. Because I think it's hard for us to recognize now how revolutionary her ideas were about the ways that gender divides us and holds us back. You know, just in one generation, a lot of the teachings from her have, you know, changed everything in a way that we can't even really remember really well the way that things were. I saw her talk a couple of times here in town, and one time she gave a talk at a, she gave the Dharma talk, what's it called, a sermon at a Catholic church on reproductive choice, and she did it so skillfully that it didn't cause a ripple. And I think part of that was her way of sort of bringing everybody into the conversation and talking about it in a way that people could get behind. The other thing, the other, the, the main thing that I remember from the two or three times that I saw her talk, you know how you go to a lecture and the only thing that you'll remember is some really random kind of aside? She was speaking at Westminster Presbyterian, and the first thing that she said was, "How many of us have been together before?" And my sense was that what she was asking was, what anybody else would have said was, "Have any of you ever come to hear me talk before?" But she sort of personified that idea of there's no separation. She never talked about I. She always talked about we. We. And believed it. I mean, you got very wrapped up in her vision. So, another of the bodhisattvas that Taigen talks about is Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. It means great activity. Or he's the bodhisattva of great activity. His name means universal virtue. You don't see a whole lot of statues of Samantabhadra. The only one that I've ever seen on an altar was at Berkeley Zen Center. I was visiting there with a girlfriend, and I saw this little statue that had a Buddha riding on an elephant. And I said, "Well, who's this?" And she said, "Oh, that's Samantabhadra." And I realized I had never seen a statue of him. But the elephant symbolizes enlightened practice and awareness. And sometimes you'll see the statue of Manjushri on one side of the altar and Samantabhadra on the other side of the altar. So Manjushri representing wisdom and Samantabhadra meaning the activity of that wisdom in the world as it gets displayed in the world. Samantabhadra in paintings will be very... I'm thinking sparkly. He's very radiant. He's very radiant. He's got that radiant kind of wisdom. I want to read you what Taigen had to say about Samantabhadra. He said, "The world is an intricate, sensitive system in which all parts are integral to the whole and in which our own beneficial activity is vital. Samantabhadra's active application of wisdom is centered on guarding and caring for the world, as expressed most directly in his vows to share the Dharma to benefit all beings. Hidden practice is important to the Samantabhadra archetype, anonymously occupying ordinary roles in society to do bodhisattva work and inspire others to do likewise. He's willing to see the workings of the world and act discreetly when possible." That's another hallmark of bodhisattvas. They're pretty much all doing it very discreetly. Transforming social systems in order to help beings. He says Samantabhadra is generative, inspiring. New Samantabhadras appear in every atom. So a couple of examples that he gives of Samantabhadra were Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Because both of them had a comprehensive vision of how they wanted society to be. They wanted to transform society. And they had the wisdom and the patience to use nonviolent action in their work in opposing systemic oppression. Another example that he gave was Pete Seeger, who was a songwriter and folk singer, who dedicated his life to a number of causes, one of which being anti-war. Another, he also got pulled in front of the an American Activities Committee in the 50s and ended up being blacklisted for years because of his political activity. Later on in life, he lived by the Hudson River, and when they found that the Hudson River was dying, you know, it was so badly polluted, he joined in a wave of activity that resulted in it getting really cleaned up. They got a sloop, a big boat together, and they would people would sail up and down the river giving talks, and he'd be singing folk songs and things about the river. And it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference. And the thing about Pete Seeger was he did it with great joy. If you've ever seen a video with him or were lucky enough to see him in concert, he always had this kind of twinkle, you know. So that's real Samantabhadra kind of activity. Avalokiteshvara. So this is she's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And her name means hearing the cries of the world. She's also known as Kuan Yin and Kanon and sometimes Kanzeon. And in the earliest statues and stories, she was depicted as a man. If you go over to the Art Institute, you can see statues of Avalokiteshvara as a man, and you can also see more recent ones of Avalokiteshvara depicting a woman. Sometimes she's shown standing on a lotus, sometimes on the back of a turtle. She's often got a bottle of water. And the water stands for the dispensing of love and virtue. Some of the statues of Avalokiteshvara, she's got 1,000 arms. And sometimes they'll show Avalokiteshvara with 6 or 7 arms. And sometimes, you'll see a statue that actually has 1,000 arms. And in each of her hands, she's got an eye that she uses to look and see what needs to be done. I kind of think it should be an ear, but it's an eye. And in each one of her hands, she'll have an implement that she can use to make change. There's a painting of Avalokiteshvara as a tenzo, as a Zen cook. And in that painting, she's got about 6 or 8 arms, and she's got like a spatula, you know, and maybe not a hamburger flipper, but, you know, some kind of flipper. She'll have a spoon, you know, she'll have all these different implements. So it's whatever is needed in this moment. So she's the Bodhisattva who's always watching. She's always listening. She's the one who can listen to people and hear their cries and hear their pain. And if needed, she'll step in and act. But a lot of times she'll just listen because that's what people need. So, let me read to you what Teigen had to say about Avalokiteshvara. He said, she's the one who calmly hears and considers all the world's sounds of woe. This name implies that empathy and active listening are primary practices of compassion. Just to be present, to remain upright and aware in the face of suffering without needing to react reflexively is compassion. Sometimes that's the hardest thing, to just listen. So, Kanzeon acknowledges beings and their cries and responds when appropriate. Often when we're troubled, what we most yearn for is this acceptance, to be heard and have our pain recognized. Such attentive presence may be more the essence of compassion than our attempts to problem solve, to manipulate the world, or to try to fix in quotation marks, fix the situation. One of Teigen's modern-day exemplars of Avalokiteshvara is Mother Teresa. And he talks about how, you know, she had this convent in Calcutta. And they'd go out into the streets and look for people in need of help. And she'd find someone just, you know, in terrible shape, lying in the gutter somewhere. And they would pick them up and take them back to the convent and, you know, feed them, clean them up, get them medical care, whatever they needed. And unlike Samantabhadra, who would be interested in fixing the socioeconomic conditions that got that person there, Avalokiteshvara doesn't stop to wonder, how they got there. She just helps, you know. She doesn't see the person in the gutter and say, well, did you do something to bring this on yourself? Or, how did you get in this kind of mess? She just helps them. She just helps them. Personally, when I think about Avalokiteshvara, I think about all of the many, many depictions of the Divine Feminine, especially Mary, the Mother of Jesus. She was a historical figure who lived through just about the most horrifying thing you can imagine. You know, seeing your child, your only child, executed in public. And going through that and developing such compassion that other people turned to her in her life and turned to her still. I have a number of aunties who love Mary, and they'll turn to her when they're in times of sorrow and pain. Sometimes you have to look pretty closely at a statue of Avalokiteshvara or Mary to figure out which one it is. So they both have, the veil. But they both have that same kind of loving, consoling presence. One way you can tell them apart is occasionally, not on this one, but on some depictions of Avalokiteshvara in statues, she'll have two or three or four heads on top of her head. And according to the legend, she saw so much pain and so much sorrow that her head split apart. And out of that grew, I think it's 81 more heads, but you usually see two or three heads that allow her to remain upright, but also allow her to see the perspectives of all kinds of different people. So I will admit Avalokiteshvara is my personal favorite. I think it's because I have all these aunties who are devoted to Mary. Somehow that imprinted on me when I saw Avalokiteshvara for the first time. Another one of the bodhisattvas that Taikin talks about in the book is Jizo Bodhisattva. His name means earth storehouse or earth womb. He's usually depicted as a male monk, but when you think about it, you know, there's a huge sort of female energy to Jizo, I think. And usually in the statues of Jizo, he's sort of androgynous. You know, you don't see a whole lot of detail. It's one of the things that I like about the statues of Jizo. It's very plain. He's the protector of travelers, women, children, and the people who are in the very, very most desperate situations. I think in the future we're going to see more female depictions of Jizo. That's my prediction. Jizo is moving in a female direction. In this one, this is a real typical Jizo statue. So he's a monk, and he has this walking stick that has rings on the top. And so when Jizo walks through the jungle in the mythology, he'll pound his walking stick with every step, and then the little rings will jingle, and that'll ward off predators, and it also warns off all the little creatures to get out of the way so they don't get stepped on. They might get crushed. There's also a Jizo statue out in the garden by the back entry to our backyard, and that's a really beautiful Jizo that a member of our Sangha bought a number of years ago when someone he loved died. And he wanted to buy a statue of a bodhisattva for a memorial garden, and was asking, you know, well, which one? Which one should I pick? And so we kind of walked through some of the bodhisattvas, and I told him about Avalokiteshvara and compassion, and he said, oh, yeah, she was so compassionate, that's it. And then I told him about Jizo, who was willing to stand with anybody in the middle of the most hellish situations. And he said, no, that's the one. That's the one. So, yeah, you should stop by and take a look at that Jizo sometime. We used to have a bench out there so you could just kind of sit. It's a really nice spot, our little memorial garden. So Jizo is the bodhisattva for travelers, and usually these days they're talking about people who are traveling through the realms, either the eight Buddhist realms of existence, or frequently it's people who are in the process of being born and living. So in Japan, from what I understand and pictures that I've seen, there are a lot of statues of Jizo Bodhisattva by the roadside and also in cemeteries. He's particularly known as the protector of children who haven't been born, fetuses, mothers, childbirth, babies. There's a wonderful ceremony that I got to go to one time that is for people who have suffered the loss of a baby. And in that ceremony, the people who were there would talk about the baby who died, and then they would sew little Jizo hats or little Jizo, sometimes a raksu or a little shawl for Jizo. And then we put them up on the altar and they would stay there for a while. It was an unbelievably sort of moving and healing ceremony. Jizo's also willing to be present, like I said, in the most hellish situations. You know, there's legends and folk tales about Jizo descending into hell to rescue people who are there because of the prayers and the supplications of people who miss them. Teigen talks about Doctors Without Borders as examples of Jizo, or prison chaplains, or people, I guess we could say now, people who visit the camps on the border. You know, they're going into situations that everybody wants to avoid, but they're willing to put themselves right there in the middle of hell for the benefit of human beings. Personally, having spent time in pediatric oncology wards and a little bit of time around NICUs, neonatal intensive care units, I think of nurses who work in those kind of environments as being, well, angels, but also complete exemplars of Jizo Bodhisattva. You know, they're right there with the kids and know how to treat them, but also they're in the middle of the parents' hell, and they transform it. It's extraordinary watching them. It's extraordinary being on the receiving end of their love and their care. Another bodhisattva that Teigen talks about in this book is Maitreya Bodhisattva. Maitreya is the future Buddha. In our meal chants during session, we chant names of some of the Buddhas, and Maitreya Buddha is listed as a Buddha. And I've lost my word. There are a number of Buddhas in the folklore of Buddhism. There are seven Buddhas who came before Shakyamuni Buddha. We're in the age of Shakyamuni Buddha. And there's also Maitreya Buddha, who's sort of on base to come next. So Maitreya Buddha, his name means the loving one. It's associated with the word Maitri, loving kindness, right? And he's another one who you don't see a lot of traditional depictions of him. You do see a lot of statues of Maitreya, though. I'll talk about that in a minute. But in the traditional ones that you don't see very often, Maitreya is young because he's sort of an apprentice Buddha, right? So he's young. And he'll be sitting with his hands under his chin and fingers on his cheek, and he's just contemplating. He's just contemplating. He's looking to the future, and he's envisioning a better world for all beings. There are wonderful stories in the folklore about villagers who someone rides into town and tells them, Maitreya's coming. Maitreya's coming. And everybody bustles around to get ready for the future Buddha. And it's very exciting. And, you know, they get out and they're lining the streets. And then what'll happen is someone in raggedy clothing will kind of come limping in, not looking at all like what they think a Buddha will. In my favorite of those stories, he's got a really sick dog, and I won't go into the specifics, but a really sick dog on his shoulder. And everybody's standing out there, and they're like, get out of the way. We're waiting for Maitreya. You know, you're kind of ruining the view here. Get out of the way. And it turns out, of course, that the dog is Maitreya. So the point of those stories is that Maitreya can be anywhere. Can be anywhere, anytime, anybody. You just never know. But the Buddha you encounter isn't going to look like you expect. I see Buddhas on the bus all the time. All the time. And a really important point about Maitreya is that he walks our streets right now. You know, he's sort of among us, is the idea of Maitreya. And you just never know who he is and what guise he's presenting as. He's based in part on a historical figure from the 10th century, a Chinese monk named Budai, and we know him better as Hotei. And you will see statues of Maitreya in just about every Chinese restaurant you go to. Everybody's like, yeah, I know that statue. Kind of rotund and smiling Buddha. That's not actually Buddha. It's Maitreya, the future Buddha. And he's known for that version of Maitreya is particularly known for being beloved of children. He loves children. Children love him. A lot of times he has a big bag and it's full of candy and toys and things. He loves to get down in the dirt and play with the kids. He's that kind of figure. So he's actually, in part, based on a historical figure. One of the other more recent figures that Taigen talks about as a manifestation of Maitreya is Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, who lived in the first half of the 18th century. And he wandered across Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and he had pockets full of apple seeds. And he would just strew them everywhere. So he's planting forests of apple trees that he's never going to live to see, that aren't going to benefit him in any way. But he's planting these seeds for the future. He also didn't look like anybody special. You never would have guessed that he was Maitreya Buddha. He was usually pretty ragged. He was also another one who loved children and was loved by children. And he was a devout Swedenborgian. Is that how you say that? So he would preach the Dharma to people as he wandered around. So, Maitreya Buddha. I see Maitreya all the time. All the time. But then I'm paying attention for him. Sometimes, on a good day, I remember to look for Maitreya. There are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of other bodhisattvas in the pantheon of bodhisattvas. If you want to read more about them, you can get the Flower Ornament Sutra, which is about this thick. And it's got sort of pages of listings of the bodhisattvas, and with all these flowery names. My favorite one, this is the bodhisattva name I want: Brave Lotus Topknot Bodhisattva. I like that one. But they have all these just unbelievable names. I was going to bring it in and read you, but I knew I wouldn't be able to stop if I started reading those names. The Dalai Lama is a bodhisattva. In the Tibetan tradition, he's considered to be a current-day incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, which, if you know anything about the Dalai Lama, makes perfect sense. His favorite verse, which comes from Shantideva's book, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, his favorite verse is printed on the bulletin today. And you could call this a job description for a bodhisattva. It's very concise, 4 lines. And now, as long as space endures, as long as there are beings to be found, may I continue likewise to remain to soothe the sufferings of those who live. And now, as long as space endures, throughout space and time, as long as there are any beings anywhere, I want to stay right here. Even if I achieve complete and total enlightenment, I'm going to stay right here and help everyone else, and soothe their suffering. So that's the Dalai Lama's charge. And I think it's part of the reason that he's been able to do such an amazing job holding the Tibetans together in the middle of their diaspora. So I wonder if anybody else has any favorite bodhisattvas, or maybe recognizes themselves or somebody else that they know or run into in those descriptions. You know, when I first found out about the bodhisattvas, I recognized Avalokiteshvara right away, and I just assumed that that was everybody's favorite bodhisattva because it was so clear to me. And but I had a girlfriend who told me Manjushri was hers, and she did have this sort of penetrating way of seeing the overall picture. She was the board chair on a board that I was on. And she just had a way of cutting through all the talk and all the blather and go, here it is. And we were talking about this one time, and she told me that she had been to see a fortune teller in Japan years ago before she knew anything about bodhisattvas. And the fortune teller told her that she had swords in her eyes, which always kind of disturbed her until she heard about Manjushri Bodhisattva. So... another friend who's very into the caretaking role of Jizo Bodhisattva. So, does anybody else have bodhisattvas that they particularly... Yeah, Benton.
Well, first I had a question. I wonder...
Yeah.
Well, a lot of Jizo statues that I see only have one arm.
They have one arm? You know, if they're wearing robes, it could. I look like I have one arm. I gave that Dharma talk one-handed, single-handedly pulling these many beings with me into the enlightening activity of the Bodhisattva. I've been reading the Flower Ornament Sutra. Can you tell? Yeah, Jizo is actually my favorite. The statues of Jizo are my favorite. I really like the way they look. They're very clean. They're very, you know, very clean lines. I like them a lot. If you walk around this building, you find all kinds of bodhisattvas. There's another Avalokiteshvara out in the garden. I walked all the way top to bottom today and just looked at all the bodhisattvas around here. It's amazing. It's amazing. Oh. Yeah, Carrie.
I guess I've always resonated with Avalokiteshvara, and I have a picture of her on my altar at home. Because I was raised Catholic, the Virgin Mary also is a figure that I turn to, mm-hmm. and feel like a mother, that if anybody can help me, with the needs of the world or, my family, is that Avalokiteshvara can do that. And, I have one that has a lot of arms, and when I feel like my load is too much for my two arms, I imagine that she helps me with that.
She's just there's something about her, and I think that the way that you see her depicted in it seems like just about every society has got some kind of divine feminine, which tells me that there's a real need and craving for that, So, yes.
Are bodhisattvas specific to Zen Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism? Or are they everything? Do they tend to differ a lot between the different traditions?
They mostly started. Well, they. I think a lot of the tradition of bodhisattvas came out of the Hinduism of the time when Buddha was teaching. With all the gods and goddesses. I think it sort of naturally arose out of that. But once it went into China, and with the advent of the Mahayana, they became a lot more sort of prominent and sort of codified, they can be really pretty different depending on, they look different, and there's also different stories about them, depending on sort of where you are. Hi, Stephanie.
Think a little bit further about bodhisattvas.
Mm-hmm.
To me, at least, the question arises, what is really an effective way to utilize them?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think historically people have used them as objects of veneration, and also in the stories of them, they find examples of how they can serve others. I think they're very inspirational, and there's also a huge devotional following, particularly in Asia, from what I understand, of Buddhas and bodhisattvas that we don't see as much of here, or else people are too afraid to talk about it because it's, it's not very scientific. But
I'd be worried about. I don't like the word worry, but I can't think of a better one. I'd be worried to follow the type of bodhisattva that I might see myself. And deplete myself. And that's why I asked the question, what's an effective way to use them? Because I think it's important to know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. And they, one of the important things that we need to do in our practice is to figure that out. How can I do this while remaining upright and while not burning myself out? How do I do that? And I asked a doctor I knew one time about that. He was a pediatric oncologist, And I said, how do you do this? How do you do this? And he said, you know, I see a lot of happy stories and happy endings, and this is going to sound brutal, but even the ones that don't have happy endings are clinically important. So that's kind of how he was able to do it, you know, working with those families. Yeah, it's a tough question. It's an ongoing question for a lot of people, particularly, you know, people who work in the helping professions, I think, you know. Yeah, you had something?
I appreciate that question. One thing that comes to mind is the church that I grew up in, they taught us this this tool that we could use for interpreting while reading the scripture. Our church had a really big emphasis on, like, actually spending time, like, one-on-one with the scriptures. And so you read a passage, and then you ask yourself a few questions. Number one, what happened? Number two, what's the underlying principle? And number three, how can I apply that principle to my circumstance here and now?
Uh-huh.
So as I hear you telling these stories, it wasn't until you mentioned, like, you brought up the question.
Yeah.
I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And then also growing up in a church that was very engaged and very service-oriented, it wasn't until I was 27 years old that I learned the term boundaries. I was like, and so I really appreciate how, like, in our sitting position, if I understand this correctly, correct me if not, like, the hand representing wisdom is supporting the hand representing compassion.
Mm. You know, I haven't heard that, but I'll bet, you know.
Anyone?
I don't know.
Okay.
Also, when the hands are in God, there you go. There you go.
Like, that really, like, reinforced to me this idea of, like, boundaries and service.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have compassion and you support it and make it so that you can continue giving compassion by exercising wisdom. And wisdom is like the balance of all of these virtues so that they're used in non-harmful ways, even to ourselves.
Yeah, wisdom and compassion go together that way. My first teacher used to describe gusho as the coming together of wisdom and compassion, because you have one and not the other, and you're just going to be completely off balance. Off balance, yeah.
This resonates with me as well. I think it's important, at least for me, to realize that none of these virtues stand alone. I think the example of compassion in itself, with no boundaries, can be a real problem. And at the beginning of your talk, a perfect example is action and wisdom working together, and the duck and cover that we all did for nuclear Holocaust, where we got down on the floor and got underneath a wooden desk in case of a nuclear explosion. You know, I think it's just like, you know, getting underneath the tinder. So there was action that, hey, we got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
With not a whole lot of wisdom backing up.
Yeah, but there was some compassion. Here's these kids. Give them something to do, you know. Doesn't bear too much thinking about, but, you know. Jeff.
In this time when the President of the United States is organizing and inflaming lynching mobs, are there particularly instructive lessons for particular bodhisattvas that we can draw on?
Boy, I think we are living in the time of Jizo. I think we are. And I think the thing about Jizo is just that willingness. That willingness and that ability, the ability to go in and face that head on. And also Samantapadra, who's interested in changing systems, you know, and changing the way that things work. But yeah, I think about Jizo a lot these days. Yeah. On that cheerful note, we have to remember Samantapadra shines.